Boag World is produced by headscape.co.uk. It's supported by Shopify.com, a designer-friendly e-commerce solution. For more information on Shopify, go to shopify.com/Boag World. On this week's show, Paul looks at the seven wonders of wireframing and Anna reviews a new micro CMS called Perch.
Hi, Paul. How are you doing?
Hi, Paul. How are you?
Hello, Paul.
Hi, Paul.
Hi, Paul and Marcus.
Hello and welcome to the first ever BoagWorld.com podcast.
Boag World!
Hello and welcome to the 100th episode of BoagWorld.com!
Hello and welcome to the 172nd episode of BoagWorld.com, the podcast for all those involved in designing, developing and running websites on a daily basis. My name's Paul Boag.
My name's Marcus Lillington.
And I think we should just pause for a second and see if the microphones can pick up the tweeting birds outside. They've stopped.
Yep. There's very some in the distance, but hey.
That's very bizarre. A minute ago they were like this choir of birds, and then as soon as we start recording they stop.
It's obviously got a bit too hot for them.
Something like that. It's a lovely day here at the barn.
It is. All the windows are open.
And it's glorious. And probably Marcus is moaning about there being light on your screen. You like to sit in the dark while you work, don't you?
It's all right, actually. It's only in the winter, obviously, when the sun's lower.
Mm.
Now it's summer time, it doesn't seem to bother me.
There we go.
There you go.
You've been shorn, I noticed.
A summer haircut.
Yeah, yeah. I'm most impressed. There is a distinct lack of it.
Sort of Navy SEAL look.
Well, not quite. Only a very kind of hippie-ish, arty Navy SEAL, maybe.
Yeah, one who needs a haircut.
Yeah.
But yeah, there you go. No, I looked at some photographs the other day. In 2006, which was the last really hot summer we had.
Yeah.
And I had really short hair, and I thought that looked quite good, because, you know, if you're all brown, you can get away with it. I can't when I'm pasty white.
You were looking a little bit like a sheepdog before you had it done, so it's probably a good thing.
We're talking about haircuts here,
Headscape, which always reminds me of a hairdresser's, so...
My sister cuts my hair, and she's not been very well lately. That's why I turned into a sheepdog.
I see. You can't afford a proper hairdresser, then.
She is a proper hairdresser. Very proper. And there's no point in going down this route, because it's really boring.
Okay. So, anything else you want to talk about, or should we just get on and do the news?
I'm going on holiday next week.
Yes! Where are you going, have you decided?
We're going to Crete.
Oh yeah, you tried to send me photographs of where you were going, and I showed total disinterest.
Yeah, you should look at them, this looks lovely.
Lovely. Well, I don't care, do I? It's not
it's meant to make you jealous.
Yeah, I know, which is why I'm not looking.
Everyone else looked.
I'm hoping the sun will keep up all next week, so when you come back, we can do the classic line of, I don't know why you went abroad, it was such lovely weather. Here, which is always the dumbest thing in the world. Yes, I went abroad because of the culture and the laid-back environment and the, you know, meeting different people.
It's also about, it'll be a million degrees in Crete. It'll never be that hot in this country, ever.
Yeah, but I don't like that level of heat, to be honest.
It's okay, because we're staying in posh hotel this year. Last year, we slummed it.
Right.
In Greece again. It was in Rhodes. I can cope with it.
Is this any more interesting than the haircut conversation, just to clarify?
I'm showing off that I'm going somewhere posh.
Yeah.
It's got air conditioning.
Okay.
That's all. I'm showing off.
We're going to go posh next year, too. But we're going to Egypt.
Next year...
Yeah.
We'll slum again, and then the following year we'll go.
Is that the way you do it?
That's how we do it.
When you say slum...
Last, it was... It wasn't dirty, the apartment we stayed in, but it was... The four of us sort of rammed into somewhere that just had, 1930s furniture.
Oh, I know, yeah.
And sort of, you know, ancient cracked tiles on the floor.
Right.
No air conditioning, 40 degrees, you know... Mm. Hard work, but cracking place. That was on a little village, a little fishing village.
So we haven't quite worked out what's going to happen over the next month or so with the podcast. We may or may not be having a break.
Yeah.
We know that Ryan and Paul are going to do some, which would be cool, and we will let you know if we're going to stop for a while. But we'll try to keep going if we can, so that's good. Should we move on to the news?
Yes, let's.
BoagWorld.com.
Okay, so our first news story looks at the issue of usability testing. And for some reason in my show notes, it seemed like a good idea for me to actually explain what usability is. Because obviously, as all of our listeners are complete morons and won't have any idea of it. And we've never mentioned usability before on the show. So I don't know quite why I did that. It seemed like a good idea at the time. But anyway, yes, usability testing obviously is one of the most, the smartest things you can do on your website, I think would be fair to say. Mm-hmm. However, many website owners don't really carry out usability testing because they perceive it as expensive and time consuming. I think when most people think of usability testing, or a lot of website owners, certainly they have images of usability labs and two-way mirrors and video cameras and expert facilitators and their bank account running dry as a result. Of course, you know, if you've listened to the show for any length of time, you'll know that it doesn't need to be that way. And a post entitled 10 Tools to Improve Your Site's Usability on a Low Budget from the Web Designers Depot outlines some of the ways you can keep costs to a minimum. The list includes tools such as Silverback, the clear left usability tool we've talked about before, ClickTales, which we've talked about before, and the Google's Website Optimizer, which we've talked about before. However, it does include some stuff that we've never come across, or I've never come across, which mm-hmm. includes Chalkmark, Userfly, and Feedback Army. So check out all of those in the article, little review of each, and obviously the opportunity to go through and play with them. Some really good, interesting tools there. So good first story. Check it out.
Okay, Paul.
You have no intention of checking out whatsoever. So why did you say okay?
I already have checked it out.
Liar.
I have.
Have you really?
All every single bit.
You're such a fact. Just for a second there. I didn't think you would have checked out each one, but I thought you might have possibly read the news story. Although you've only just been given the show notes, so that would be fairly unlikely.
Fairly unlikely.
Except, obviously, now you follow Boag's links on Twitter.
Not on Twitter, but I still get...
you get the RSS feed.
Yeah, the RSS feed.
Yeah.
And I will click on, I don't know, 1 in 100.
It's that level of commitment I respect, yeah. Marcus. Okay, the big story of the week, really mine.
I've seen this. I've read about this.
Go on then.
Zeldman's post.
You turn a bit of paper over and explain all the pros and cons of it.
Now, I have got an opinion on this.
Okay.
Which I will save till the end.
Shall we actually tell the listener what this is
yes,
first?
Yes, go on then.
This is the campaign to fix Outlook 2010. And this comes about because Microsoft are planning to continue using the Word rendering engine to display HTML emails in the next version of Outlook. So this means that for the next 5 years, your email design will need to use tables for layout, have no support for CSS like floats or positions, no background images, and lots more. Unsurprisingly, this has caused a passionate response from the web design community, with literally thousands of blog posts and tweets expressing outrage. I think for me, Zeldman summed it up best in his post Sour Outlook when he wrote, "It's outrageous that the CSS standard created in 1996 is not properly supported by Outlook 2010. It's difficult to believe that in 2009, after diligently improving standard support in IE7 and now IE8, Microsoft would force email designers to use non-semantic table layout techniques that fractured the web, squandered bandwidth, and made a joke of accessibility back in the 1990s. Unfortunately, it looks unlikely that Microsoft are going to change their mind. They've actually responded to the outcry in a statement where they said, get it, I just love this. We've made the decision to continue using the word for creating email messages because we believe it's the best email authoring experience around, with rich tools that our Word customers have enjoyed for 25 years.
That is a true statement. The next one isn't.
Why do you say that's a true statement?
I'll come on to it in a minute.
Okay. The line that amused me the most then is this. Word has always done a great job of displaying the HTML which is commonly found in emails around the world. I try to be objective when it comes to sharing the news on the show, but honestly, this is an absolute joke for me. Ben Ward summed up my response to this statement when he writes, "I've tried to write different responses to this sentence, different witty reworkings running through my head, and some of them have been quite good. Yet every time I touch the keys, all I can write is, well, FU. I'll limit it. So go on then, what's your position on this particular issue?
There's two different things here. One is the creation of email messages.
Yes.
Every day,
yes.
Email messages.
Yeah.
And there's the display of HTML.
Yeah.
If they could display HTML, not using Word, but continue to use Word as your everyday email creation engine, mm-hmm. that would be the ideal.
But
and I have a reason why this is particularly pertinent at the moment. Mm-hmm. I have just gone from Outlook to Mail.
Yeah.
And Mail's fine, apart from its, frankly, backward creation tools that I've got when I'm creating just a normal email. Mm-hmm. Whereas Word is superb at that. That's what it does. It does creating documents.
Mm-hmm.
So that is that's where they're coming from on that first statement. It's like, well, everybody likes Word, so we're going to carry on using it.
Yeah.
And that's what it's all about.
But, I mean, okay, to take setting aside whether or not email should even be HTML, the thing is that Microsoft actually have some very good tools for creating HTML that are as intuitive to use as Word in terms, I'm thinking about Expression Web and that set of spangly new tools they've got.
It comes
even
down
if,
to...
Even if they didn't, to recreate the basic things that you need for creating an HTML email in terms of, you know, tables and image insertion and formatting and all that kind of stuff, there are hundreds of WYSIWYG editors out there that are more than capable of doing that.
But don't do it exactly the same way that Word does, and your average user in an office
moan. But it can be made to look exactly like Word.
If it could make it so it really did, because WYSIWYG editors don't. They don't do things like add capital if you forget to put it on a name. They don't, if you put two capitals right at the start of a word, they don't get rid of the second one and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff is
but that's
what
built
your
into
everyday,
the operating system. Not just into Word, is it not?
No, it's just a Word thing.
Oh, right.
That's the kind of level that your everyday office worker wants in their email. That's why Microsoft are staying where they're at.
Yeah. We will part company over this one.
Okay. I'm not saying it's right. I'm just saying that's the thinking. Mm. I'm certain of it.
Mm. But I think some compromise, and it would be only a minor compromise, is worthwhile. And even that kind of stuff could be built. Mm. Basically, what it comes down to is that, you know, the Outlook team can't be bothered. They can't be bothered to invest the time in creating a proper, you know, WYSIWYG. They're just bolting in Word because it's cheap.
Yep.
Anyway.
Yes, move on.
So, yes, this is a complete tangent here. I've got a strange job. I told you it's a tangent.
Yeah.
So my job's a mix of sales, marketing, and user experience design. And I often find it hard to reconcile what appears to be on the surface very different roles. However, I've come to understand recently that there is a common thread that runs through all of these, and that's psychology. Whether I'm designing a user interface or pitching to a potential client, I'm essentially doing the same thing. I'm trying to anticipate a person's needs and nudge them in a certain direction, right?
That's coercion, then.
Manipulation, which is equally bad.
Yes.
Do you remember the conversation we had about this with Andy Budd at South By?
Yes.
Where I kept using words like coercion. We were talking about sales process. And basically, Clear Left and us probably do very similar things in the sales process, except we used much more kind of controversial wording, didn't we, just to wind up Andy.
We analyse...
We were truthful.
Exactly, yes. And Andy was lying.
Yeah.
If you're listening, Andy, hello.
This is really childish, and I think it shows me in an extremely poor light. But in last week's show, this really is a tangent. In last week's show, right, I was going on about, you remember I was having the argument with Dave about Elastic versus pixel-based and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I
was playing, you were wrong. Dave was right, yeah.
I was playing devil's advocate in the conversation. One of the things I said is that the problem with having an Elastic site is it actually can cause horizontal scrolling when you page zoom it, right? That was one of my arguments. And so Jeremy Keith posted an indignant post on my on the show notes saying that's entirely false. And I was like, oh, shit, I've got it wrong again, which I do. occasionally get things wrong.
Really? Sorry, I didn't catch that.
So in, but I discovered in IE, I swore I'd seen this, and yeah. It is actually true. In IE7, it screws up. So I was all smug because I got something right. Jeremy got
it wrong. IE7 doesn't count. In Jeremy World, probably.
Probably not. No, that's a very fair comment. And to be fair, I didn't actually specify in the show that it was IE7 I was talking about.
No.
But it was.
So you're wrong anyway.
So really, I shouldn't have brought the whole thing up.
Yes.
Okay. Just what are we talking about?
Trying to score points, as ever.
I'm just so childish. Yes. I wish I wasn't.
You're talking about coercion, or psychology, as you call
it. Okay, should we get back onto that?
Yes.
Then? Oh, I won't talk about how there are other people that I wish I was.
Move on.
I've lost my place. Yeah. So whether I'm, yes, I'm trying to nudge people in a certain direction and anticipate their needs. That's it, right? Hmm. So basically, understanding the way that human mind works is invaluable when running a successful website designing a successful website. So whether it's understanding how users make judgments about your site or how to influence their decision making, psychology is an important component. And this issue of Alistair Part, a post entitled Visual Decision Making, delves into the mind of users. And in particular, it focuses on these users' ability to draw conclusions about a site in less than a 20th of a second. It's also a rebuttal of Jacob Nielsen's assertions that graphics play very little role in influencing users. Mm. The author presents a really well-considered argument and draws on a number of excellent sources, including Malcolm Gladwell's book Blink, which I've talked about before on the show. I would therefore strongly encourage you to read the article if you're involved in user experience design or wish to understand your users better. I'm really into this. It's an area that really fascinates me, which I guess because of all the different strands of what I do, it's not surprising that it's of interest to me. But yeah, really good post, that one.
Okay, good design is about helping people make decisions. Ugh. That's a nice way of saying coercing
them. Of course,
them.
Yeah. It is. It's about nudging them in the right direction, which is another book, isn't it? Nudge, that I talked about on the show.
Anyway.
So there's actually another article I want to mention from Alistair Part. They get two this week. Back in show 166, I mentioned that Google was starting to include microformats and RDFA in their search results. And this provides users with richer search results that include reviews, contact details, and more. But for website owners, it provides the ability to stand out in the search results and an opportunity to give users additional information that may encourage them to click through. Now, although Google is only displaying this extra information on a small number of sites at the moment, this will change, and so we need to be ready for it. Now is the time to start integrating microformats and RDF into your site. Now, we've talked about microformats a lot before, but we haven't talked about RDFA. And I have to confess, this is mainly because my own ignorance on the subject, it has to be said, that I don't know a lot about it. Fortunately, there's this other post that I wanted to mention on Alistair Part, an introduction to RDFA, which explains what RDFA is and gives examples of how it can be used on your site. At the most basic level, and I do mean the most basic level, RDFA is a framework of kind of metadata created by the W3C. So much like microformats, it aims to allow computers to better understand the content that has been written with human, for humans, and that content hasn't been written with machines in mind. And right. So that kind of RDFA corrects that balance. So like microformats, the implementation of RDFA seems very straightforward. There's nothing stopping you really from getting started. And it looks like Alistair Part can do a series of posts that will take you step by step through the process. So keep an eye on those.
Okay.
That basically sums up the news for today.
Bugbear.com.
Feature. Right, this week we're going to explore wireframes and the benefits that they provide in terms of time and money. Wireframes have become very much a kind of intrinsic part of the way that we work at Headscape, and I want to explain why we're so enthusiastic about them and how you can use them in your process. However, before we do that, let's take a step back and look at exactly what we mean by wireframes. I think it's easy to think of wireframes as kind of the HTML prototypes of entire websites, or at least key sections. And although this is certainly one type of wireframing, it's not the one that I want to focus on. The problem with HTML prototypes is that they're time-consuming and expensive. And building a functional prototype takes a lot of work and in most cases is discarded once the final design phase has begun. Unless you find a way of turning your prototype into a working site, this strikes me as a bit of a waste of resources. And in my opinion, this cost precludes their use on anything but the largest and most complex projects. They do have their place, but probably not in most projects. However, wireframing doesn't need to be like that. A headscape, the majority of wireframing that we do is hand-drawn sketches, and it's these that I want to focus on. And I want to tell you seven benefits that they provide. I have to go for seven because I wanted the seven wonders of wireframing as my title.
Okay. What so, if there were eight?
Then I would have had to have pretended one of them didn't exist.
Oh, no.
And as it is, I've probably had to take one and stretch it out into two or three.
What about things like PowerPoint and the like for creating wireframes?
No, not, well, yes. No. Yes, they can be used as a tool, but that's not what this article is about.
Okay.
I'm concentrating on the real quick, sketchy stuff.
Okay.
All right? We could do a whole session on that kind of thing, and I do vaguely touch on it at the end, but that's not the primary focus of what I'm getting at. I'm talking about sketching, really.
Okay.
So, number one benefit is it improves team working. For us, wireframing is not just the responsibility of the designer or the user experience expert. It's something everybody participates in. We will regularly bring together the designer, the developer, the project manager, and whoever else is involved in the project to wireframe key functionality. This is valuable because it involves team working and helps each member to better understand the roles of others. It's also an excellent way of breaking the waterfall model of running projects where each team member essentially works in isolation, handing off work to the next person. Number two is that it improves communication. These group wireframing sessions not only improve teamwork, and they also improve communication. We used to suffer from a problem where developers were not included enough early enough in the project cycle, and this led to functionality being promised that was difficult or impossible to build. By including everybody in the wireframing process, the problem has been eliminated. A developer will quickly spot issues in a wireframe that may be missing if... that may be missed if buried with an email thread or functional spec. It's much easier.
They'll
to
say
see stuff.
You can't do that and stuff like that.
Yeah, but they could say it then,
rather
than when it's too late. And expecting people to read through threads of email where it mentions in one line something, it's not going to get spotted. And to be honest, that's the beauty of wireframing, because they're visual. They're much easier to grasp, I think. Mm. Specification documents and emails are fine, but they're harder to visualize. And perceptions can vary. Wireframes leave much less room for misunderstanding. Number three is that wireframes provide more engagement with your client. Not only can they help improve internal communications, they also can improve communications with the client. Engaging with the client continually throughout the project is really important. And this is especially true when it comes to visual design, as I said in my session a couple of weeks ago where we talked about the designer-client battles. A client who has seen a wireframe and has been given the opportunity to provide feedback is much more likely to sign off the final design. With some of our clients, we go even further and include them in the wireframing process. And we found that with the right client, this significantly increases the quality of work. And I'm talking about having them in the room while we create the wireframes.
Yeah, I did that. I really got into doing that at the beginning of this year with an existing client of ours, Nats.
Oh, right.
It's going back to using PowerPoint. It was a sort of... We just happened to pick that as a tool.
Yeah.
There are issues with it, and the fact that it's a sort of landscape layout, what is essentially a portrait design. But it works so well. We basically just sat down in this room with the client and started off on paper and just transferred it over to PowerPoint as we were working.
I think it gives the client a much better sense of ownership over it, which I think is quite important. Number four is that it allows you to create, hand-drawn wireframes allow you to create more approaches, because they're so quick to produce, and all you need is a pen and some paper and a few seconds to sketch something out. It's amazingly liberating. It lets you explore loads more approaches than you would, when doing full comp production, so to speak. Much of our approach is based on Leah's presentation at South by Southwest. Oh, of course, we haven't actually... we've done an interview with her, but we haven't done it. It hasn't appeared on the show yet. So you'll find out more about that. There's also a link in the show notes, baragwell.com/podcast/ 172, where you can actually watch her presentation from South by. So check that out. She encourages the production of a wide variety of wireframes, tackling the problem from many different angles. We produce wireframes aimed at different groups, different levels of expertise, and with the emphasis on different business objectives or brand values. The aim is to generate as many ideas as possible. And once you've established a wide variety of approaches, you can then refine and discard and combine until you end up with two or three. You know, it's impossible really to explore that many different approaches in any other way. My fifth reason for liking hand-drawn wireframes is that they're great. They can be used for testing. Once you've got your two or three wireframes with potential, the next step is to test them with real users. Now, there's a perception that you need to be testing against, you know, completed comps or HTML prototypes. However, I don't really think that's the case. There is real benefits in testing even from the most basic hand-drawn wireframes, as you can ask things like, you know, what would the user click on to complete a certain task? You know, the user can give feedback about naming and labeling and that kind of stuff. And you can also establish whether you've got the right visual hierarchy. Obviously, testing against a hand-drawn wireframe is not as informative as testing against a final site. However, it does help you to identify some problems before too much time has been invested. And that brings me on to point number six, really, which is a greater willingness to change. The problem with user testing final designs or HTML prototypes types or worse, a completed site, is that a considerable amount of work has already been done, and this makes it hard to actually change what has been done. You know, the same is true if a client rejects a final design. Hours of work has gone into that design, and the designer feels committed to that approach. There's a substantial cost of starting again. But that's not the case with hand-drawn wireframes, because they're so quick and easy to produce, and it costs nothing to discard them and try another approach. And this willingness to change makes it much more responsive to the results of user testing or feedback from the client. So to finish off, really, my last reason for liking hand-drawn wireframes is that they create faster and cheaper projects. You know, ultimately, they bring cost down and prevent slippage. And this is because the developer has been involved in wireframing right from the beginning, and so isn't surprised by any unseen functionality, mm-hmm. Which might, you know, increase the cost or extend the timescales. The client, you know, has seen the wireframes, and so is more likely to sign off the final design, reducing expensive iterations and multiple concepts. And the user testing has been done early enough in the project to catch any significant problems before it becomes expensive to fix those problems. So wireframing up front also reduces the uncertainty in a project. You know, it's possible to budget for and schedule in wireframing. However, it's much harder to do that with unforeseen complexity or multiple iterations. So it's worth noting that, you know, the hand-drawn wireframes do have their drawback. We found that sketching becomes messy and confusing, especially once you've drawn and redrawn them based on feedback.
Yeah.
And it can lead to confusion, and it also doesn't look very professional when presenting to your client. So we've therefore taken to kind of recreating our final wireframes in a more polished version. And this has become the definitive document that we've worked with. It's at this stage we add more detail in terms of copy and making a more complete roadmap to work from. When we first started this process of final wireframing, they were very polished. However, we discovered this actually can cause confusion amongst some clients who've mistook them for the final design. Sad but true. We've also found that producing these can be time-consuming and so undermine the benefit of hand-drawn sketches. Now, this is where we get into the realms of maybe using PowerPoint. But a tool that I think I'm trying to encourage everybody to move across to at Headscape is a tool called Balsamiq, which can be used for producing these wireframes. The reason I like Balsamiq is because it's amazingly quick to produce the wireframes, but they also still look like wireframes rather than final designs.
Yeah, I like it. It looks really good.
Yeah,
PowerPoint's not good. I mean, the only good thing about PowerPoint is it's quick.
Yeah.
And you can create links. You can have a clickable wireframe.
Yeah. Which you can now do with Balsamiq. With both of those things. It is quick and you can interlink pages.
I'd like to apologise to all the listeners for all the cars that are going by.
Yeah.
It seems that, you know, our tiny little lane has suddenly had about 10 cars going by. Sorry about that.
So let's conclude by just, you know, saying that I think too often we start the design process by opening Photoshop. However, although Photoshop is a powerful tool, I think it's the wrong place to start, really. It's a bit like a sledgehammer to crack a nut. You may shy away from, you know, sketching wireframes because you feel you can't draw. However, it's not about your artistic ability. It's about, you know, quickly and visually communicating ideas. Wireframes should be fast and furious. And I actually believe that too much artistic ability and being overly precious can, you know, damage the quality of the stuff that you're doing. Hopefully this post has communicated the benefits of wireframing and hand drawing them and encouraging you to close your MacBook and open your sketchbook.
Cool.
A nice little kind of pun to finish on.
Is it? Isn't that, it's not a pun, is it?
I don't know. What would you call that?
It's got a name.
Stupid. Okay. Anyway, we're going to move on to a review, which is going to be Anna talking about a new product released by Edge of My Seat, which is a micro CMS, which are all the rage these days.
Hi, I'm Anna, and I'm going to tell you a bit about a new micro CMS I've been trying out called Perch by edgeofmyseat.com. If you're looking for a powerful CMS with lots of features that writes your blog posts, walks your dog and does the dishes for you, this probably isn't for you. But if you ever build static sites where it's hardly worth plugging a CMS into a tool, but you still want to give the client the option to edit the content themselves, or maybe you're a designer who just wants to design sites and not get dragged into CMS code hell, this could be the perfect solution. Perch is very adaptable and it's easy to plug into an existing site. I did just this and it took me about an hour altogether, and that was the first time I ever used the system. Ideally, you shouldn't have to build a site around a particular CMS. You should be able to build a site, then plug into the CMS and only let the client edit the copy, not the layout. You don't want it to mess with your code, and you want the backend to be compatible with even the most technologically challenged of your clients. Perch does all of the above. It installs onto the web server you host the site on, rather than storing it on Perch's website, so if the Perch website goes down, your user can still update their site. Before Perch came out, I was using Cushy CMS, which works in a similar way. Their site went down, and I suddenly got an influx of emails from clients who couldn't edit their sites. Perch's approach is also more secure than trusting another company with your FTP details. Installing Perch is really straightforward. You download the setup file from the website, unzip it, and drop it into your home directory. Then you navigate to the setup page, complete a form with your MySQL database settings, copy the code it generates, and paste it into a configuration file. Then you integrate the CMS into your site by adding a PHP include tag to the top of each page and PHP tags in the page where the editable content will be. When you log into Perch, it will have recognized these tags and set up the editable interface for the content. Within a page, you can have more than one editable region. You set a template for each region that you can define yourself. You may just have a block of text that you want the client to be able to change, just to use the text template. You can even allow multiple items in a region, so for example you had a news page, you could let the user add news items rather than editing a whole body of text. The backend is very clean, simple, and also brandable, so you can add your logo and change the colours to personalise the interface. There's some handy documentation that's been updated a lot since I first tried it out, and you can also contact the developers with any questions. The prices are £35 one-off payment per domain, which I think is a really sensible payment option, especially for freelancers who don't maintain long-term relationships with their clients. There's also a server compatibility test you can download to check the CMS is compatible with your server, and I'd recommend you try out their live demo first at grubberperch.com to see if it's right for you.
Okay, thank you very much, Anna. It's good to have Anna on the show where she's not having to make stuff up on the fly, because I don't think she likes that very much.
No.
But it was a really good good review. And I have to say, Perch looks really interesting. If you're just doing little flat sites, being able to kind of whack a content management system behind it with minimal effort is really good, really good. Good job, guys, at Edge of My Seat. That's Drew and Rachel. And so you know it's going to be a quality product. And it's cheap, which is another good thing about it. Right, I think that wraps up today's show, except for Marcus's witty and amusing joke.
Yeah, obviously, you know, you kind of have a go at me for the jokes, but they're not my jokes. They're jokes people send to me. So
yeah,
if it's not a good one, it's obviously nothing to do with me.
But it's the delivery, isn't it?
Well,
I mean,
yes.
You look at... Take Jimmy Carr, for example. Jimmy Carr's jokes are terrible. But there's something about his delivery that makes them really funny.
They're not all terrible.
Some of them
are quite funny. But anyway, here we go. Sorry, I forgot who sent this to me, but...
You're so crap. You never give credit where credit's due.
Never is too strong. Maybe 50% of the time. I obviously don't care enough. Anyway, here we go.
You don't care about our listeners. You're a bad man.
Yeah, it's true. No, it's not true. Anyway, stop it.
Okay.
Man goes to a yoga class and asks the teacher, "Can you teach me how to do the splits?" The yoga teacher replies, "Well, it depends how flexible you are." The man thinks for a while, then responds, "Well, I can't make Wednesdays." Say goodbye, Paul.
Right, thank you very much for listening to this week's show. It was a pleasure as always, and I'm in a silly mood.
La la la.
I've lost it now entirely.
It's summer, and we probably shouldn't even be in here.
No. So we'll say goodbye. Go have a life outside and enjoy your week. Talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hello, world of
Bowen.
Like being on David Letterman.
Poag World! Poag World!
Show, visit bowagworld.com/contact, call 020 8133 5122.